warmers, some nearly as big as our outspread hands. Paddling out of the main current and into deeper backwaters, we listened to the chirp of young alligators where boats don't go, the river breaking and breaking again. I looked back into a small tree-trunked cove where little alligators slid from their mother's back and fished through the water. The mother sank to her snout, so I could only see her nostrils, eyes, and ridge of a tail. She turned to watch me pass. We made eye contact, if that's possible, with a reptile. Her babies swam around her like polywogs, little tails working the water. The original canal walls built by slaves were still visible, rough stacks of limestone threaded with roots, half covered with leaves under squat palms and long-leafed pines. Each rock had been broken from the ground with a pickaxe, pried up and stacked. I reached out and touched one as I passed, the limestone pitted and moss-bound, history stacked on history. Around 1850, slaves were sent out by cotton plantations around the head of the Wasissa to build a new channel to take cotton barges to the Gulf. The Wasissa falls into sinkholes and sloughs, no place for a barge, so another route was needed. In the heat and pit vipers, they chopped a new water route across 10 miles of lowland swamp and forest with pickaxes and shovels, breaking out pieces of limestone floor and building them into canal walls. The canal took them through a region of hundreds of Timucuan mounds, remains of prehistoric chiefdoms estimated to have reached up to 200,000 people, extinct by the start of the 19th century, their language lost. Diggers must have encountered artifacts as they trenched across the lowlands, impossible not to see colorful Timucuan pottery and glassy rock chips in the soil. Down deeper they would have found archaic shell middens and piled up encampments. Slaves might have been the first archaeologists, recognizing cultural distinctiveness in different horizons of Earth. The deeper they went, the larger the stone weapons would have appeared, breaking into lenses of ancient campfires, layers of earth darkened by ash and cooked bone. In the deepest levels were mastodon bones and tusks and the skulls of saber-toothed cats and American lions. A man, laced with sweat, might have held up a fluted marvel, a stone projectile for taking down beasts 20 times his size. It must have conjured a scale of animal that could have only existed in legend. Turning the long and elegantly flaked weapon, wiping off its surface, the digger must have wondered what history was in this ground, what new country he'd discovered. The largest, most refined weapons in ancient America were seen on this side of the continent first. Once you see one of them, its shape is unforgettable. A piece of stone is reduced from both sides until it is thin, light, and long. The projectile conspicuously lacks the tail of the Western stem tradition, and instead has a concave butt, shedding a small amount of weight from the back end. This technology was nuclear for its age, the height of Ice Age stonework, lightweight yet strong, able to break in such a way that it could be quickly repaired. There was a confidence in the work, knowing exactly how a stone would respond to blows from an antler or from another stone. Modern-day professional knappers, people who replicate ancient toolwork, will tell you that making one of these is an aesthetic statement, a fine skill that went beyond mere function. Archaeologists in Florida working the Ocilla River in the 1990s, and other sites from here on up the eastern seaboard, the Topper site along the Savannah River in Allendale County, South Carolina, and the Cactus Hill site along the Nodaway River in Virginia, have found many of these fine early points. Topper and Cactus Hill revealed them in layers of dirt and sand dating to 18,000 and 20,000 years ago, possibly echoes of a Solutrean landing. They might have needed more refined weapons in the deadly landscape of the southeast, forged on the savannas of Florida. Smaller stemmed points and atlatl darts may not have been enough. Around 13,000 years ago, a new signature appears on these weapons. They become fluted, the word coming from the fluting of columns in Greek architecture. The marks were made by single, well-placed blows that knocked a channel into the projectile. The purpose of fluting is unclear. It could have assisted attachment to the shaft or taken weight off, enough so it could be thrown from an atlatl with remarkable accuracy. One suggestion has been that it channeled blood. giving an airspace large enough that an animal would be weakened and fall sooner than if the point were firmly embedded in flesh. The fluting serves as a stylistic signifier, a way of expressing identity. After Pacific Rim stemmed points, this is the next cultural appearance, indicating not just people, but another people. Alex bears a tattoo on the softer underskin of his left forearm. Gothic black letters spell out Cero Sed Serio, his Scottish clan motto from the Battle of Ancram Moor in AD 1545. Late, but in earnest. The motto of Clan Kerr. The Kerrs were mercenaries that the British brought to this borderland battle against the Scots. They waited to enter the fight and at the last moment joined the Scots. Now replenished with fresh, strong troops eager to fight, the Scots drove back the Brits. Clan Kerr turned the tide, carrying into victory their new motto, which might also be translated, better late than never. Alex had recently returned to those borderlands, visiting the castle his people built. He sat beneath an aged oak tree, its heavy limbs held up by wooden supports, the same oak that stood there in 1545. Sitting under that tree with his brother, in the very place where their clan gained its motto, he felt a sense of origin he'd never known before. This was his oldest sighting of his own bloodline. He told me, "Even if you're not going to live there, even if you aren't going to return, you have that zero latitude, zero longitude from which to understand the world." We each have a place and time to remember. Alex's is along the Scottish borderlands, while many Native Americans hark back to springs and holes in the ground or a headstone in an Alaskan forest in Tlingit territory. I have a turtle tattooed onto my back as a compass and a raven feather on my shoulder from the Grand Canyon where I watched two ravens battle a falcon. A lone black feather floated to the ground and I picked it up, a talisman. Raven who stole the sun, moon, and stars. Raven who flew across an ice sheet. These are my ways of recording my place. Maybe I've jumped ship, defecting to this continent. I am European, with the bloodlines of Wales and Germany, and I live here, in North America, my oldest personal memories coming from this new ground. I came to Florida looking for the human source on this side of the planet, the holes in the earth from which people far older than I have emerged, some of the oldest widespread archaeology in the New World. This is where the slave canal led us onto the broad, dark Asilla, a river that people followed in the Ice Age, their artifacts continuing even off the land and out into the Gulf, where sites are found by sonar and excavated with vacuums. We passed beneath the concrete pylon bridge of Highway 98, about 5 miles from where the Asilla opens onto the Gulf. The bridge surface is made of metal grate, which caused a terrific roar whenever a vehicle passed overhead every minute or so. The Wasissa had turned into the Asilla, both rivers finished dropping into siphon holes, and now were on a one-way route to open water. Ramshackle huts and cabins appeared downstream of the bridge, American flags raised, moldy old skiffs tied off. Plastic chairs, propane bottles, screened-in porches, some had money and lawns, and others, backwoods shacks, looked ready to go with the next big storm. Cormorants, enthroned in cypress trees like judges, peered down on us as the sky opened wide. The Asilla spread into the Gulf of Mexico until it let go of itself, brown curls of water winding into milky brine. 14,000 years ago, the river would have flowed for a couple hundred more miles across land now underwater. Sea levels have risen, and most of the exposed continental shelf has been lost. The Asilla truncated, half of Florida gone. Archaeologists have been mapping drowned river channels, sending divers who have found stone tools at sunken confluences and submerged riverbanks. Sites are mapped using side-scan sonar and multi-beam bathymetry, which turns echoes into acoustic images. Shell middens or rock outcrops produce high backscatter arrays, which is where the drowned course of the Asilla and its tributaries have turned up 4,500 pieces of chipped stone and broken spear points 30 feet below the surface, with more expected. For people who knew these places when they were exposed, the sea must have seemed as if it were closing like a noose, the world being overrun, coming to an inevitable end if the water kept rising. Flood stories are deeply bound into Native American mythology. Between 15,000 and 12,000 years ago, ice sheets rapidly collapsed and floods 100 miles wide raged down the Mississippi. The outflow squeezed between Cuba and Florida, erasing most of the Bahamas as the water went for the Atlantic. This left the keys and islands we see today. Sea levels rose in surges and did not go back down. The upsurges were not the inches and quarter inches we dread today, but feet and yardsticks, miles going under as people watched. A breeze across this choppy water put brine on our lips as we glided over grasslands, over the backs of animals that once lived below the sea level. Under the water, mastodons returned to the river. Wolves and big cats prowled the woods. I looked over my kayak, seeing people dressed lightly, slipping through the grass, atlatls raised as they went silently after a glyptodont, its round and armored back clearly visible from up here, its helmet-like head down and grazing. We wanted to find an exposed shoreline to set up camp, but once the river fanned into Apalachee Bay, the land all but disappeared, turning into a tidal marshland, a low-energy coastal environment, hardly a coast at all. The forests we'd been paddling through were miles behind us, leaving only hammocks, islands of palms and cedars, isolated across miles of salt marsh. With sunset coming on, we hugged the shore, or what passed for it, finding only doorways for alligators through stiff reeds. They were getting bigger, forming tunnels wider than my kayak. Some of the alligators might have been approaching Pleistocene size. We spotted clumps of palms, miles back into the sloughs, thinking we could land on one and find a place to sleep. The tide receded as we paddled inlets and outlets, a warren of islands and sloughs and still no land. The sun peeled into an orange glow, lighting hammocks far away. The tide dropped faster, its current picking up against us, draining back into the gulf. The chance of reaching a hammock escaped us as we floundered through a tidal maze, crusty banks of exposed oysters grating against our plastic hulls. "This was a bad idea," said Pete, who was out of his canoe, standing in a shallow with his pants rolled up. Alex stepped out in calf-deep water and said nothing, looking around, considering our options. Under a raspberry sky, he pulled out the GPS, the first time the device had been used. The satellite map on the screen made it look as if we were folded into the convolutions of a brain. We were 8 miles northwest of the mouth of the Ikenfena River, and that was all we knew. GPS could not help us. "Whatever we're going to do, we better do it soon," Pete said. That was the ranger in him talking. He'd seen or heard of enough grisly, stupid mistakes in wild environments. He could already imagine us capsized, swamped in mud, trying to make it out of a marsh on foot or by swimming in the company of large, unseen alligators. "We could sleep in our boats," Alex offered. Pete folded his arms. "I'm just saying we should make a call." We'd failed to ask either Ed or Jim what to do when, if, we got this far. I didn't want to sleep sitting up in a hard plastic coffin, not with alligators bumping around in the dark. We picked a muddy shoal and dragged our boats up. Every step sucked out of the ground. Leathery, sharp, black-needled rushes stood chest tall, the ground a sponge-like soil of organic remains, not quite land, not quite water. Our two small tents went up. Alex and Pete kept their canoe close, and I put my kayak beside mine, tying it to a tent pole, so that if the water came up, the kayak and I wouldn't drift apart. We had dinner barefoot, headlamps on, the sky indigo. Pete sat in a folding chair and cooked on a little white gas stove, blue circle of flame, battered old windscreen wrapped around it, tools of the first people to land on this piece of marsh in this century. Mosquitoes were a nuisance, but not as bad as the swarms of biting, flying insects no bigger than poppy seeds. The worst of them began to drop off as cool breezes came in off the water. With every step and movement, we released a rich stink from the ground. Tiny black crabs crawled across our feet as we walked to the edge of the reeds, checking the tide, squishing down into the water. None of us wanted a swampy night, to have to throw tents and gear into boats in a midnight hurry. I thought of a prayer for an easy sleep, for sea levels not to make a marked rise that night, But who was I to pray against the sea? 7 horses and 1 camel were attacked and butchered near a river crossing in Alberta, Canada, 13,300 years ago, in a corridor of land opening between ice sheets as Alaska and Yukon connected with the lower 48 in warming conditions. Butchered bones of a giant ground sloth dating to between 13,738 and 13,435 years ago were found in northern Ohio. The tip of a projectile made of mastodon bone was found embedded in the vertebra of a 13,800-year-old mastodon on the Olympic Peninsula of coastal Washington. A 13,400-year-old kill site called El Fin del Mundo, the end of the world, was excavated in the desert of northwest Mexico, where along with the remains of at least 2 butchered gomphotheres, long-jawed, 4-tusked, elephant-like animals, spear points, flakes, scrapers, and an exquisite, completely intact, transparent quartz fluted point were found. The list of big animals being hunted, or at least butchered, keeps on. Mammoths cut up in Wisconsin and Arizona, protein residues on points and butchering blades from across the country. A long-stemmed weapon known as a hasket from the Western stem tradition and not Clovis was recovered in Utah with proboscidian proteins from mammoths or mastodons in its pores. Matthew Hill, a zooarchaeologist at the University of Iowa, looked at 60 Paleolithic kills and carcass processing sites from the middle of the continent to see what most people were hunting. Hill wrote, "In the low-diversity grasslands of the high plains and rolling hills, prehistoric groups hunted large game almost exclusively. 99% of the faunal remains he cataloged came from 8 animals, bison, rabbits and hares, pronghorn, mammoth, turtle, bighorn sheep, deer, and prairie dog. The 2 largest, bison and mammoth, ranked near the top in numbers, partly due to their having the longest lasting bones, and because they were either preyed upon or scavenged by humans." Hill concluded, "No matter what quantitative measure is used, large game dominates Paleo-Indian zooarchaeological resources. Of the Great Plains, that is. Smaller kills and smaller camps, which were probably the norm, have either not survived or rarely surface. The mountainous west and the west coast appear to have been more diversified, stemmed and fluted points meeting among varied microclimates of taiga, grasslands, lakes, and alpine glaciers. In the southern Rockies, 8 kinds of projectiles were in primary use, from Clovis to stem points and varieties in between, and big animals were not their main focus. The Great Plains had a different hunting trajectory. Eventually, it would be known for bison hunts on horseback and woolly beasts shot from the windows of trains. During the Ice Age, the same land saw some of the biggest megafauna hunting forays. Extinctions mounted at the end of the Ice Age. Most short-faced bears exited somewhere between 10,800 and 11,000 years ago, the same extinction range for many other North American Ice Age megafauna. A single Arctotis bone sample from Bonner Springs, Kansas, just west of Kansas City, has a date of 9,600 years old, evidence of the last of the last edging into the Holocene. The extinctions happened at different rates depending on the location. Wildlife ranges shrank as hunters pressed across the Great Plains in search of retreating herds. And environmental changes were everywhere. It wasn't just human expansion. A geologic era was falling apart. At the warming end of the Pleistocene, prehistoric Floridians watched entire landscapes disappear. The Gulf Stream stuttered in the flush of fresh, cold water melting from the ice caps, climatic systems becoming jumpy, the Ice Age coming to a wildly fluctuating halt over thousands of years. Rising seas gobbled up the mouth of the Ascilla as the faraway ice sheets retreated in a bluster of floods. Florida's mastodon savanna and pine mosaics went under so fast that dead trees would have stood like candlesticks half a mile across the bay. Researchers examining the underwater courses of the Ascilla and other nearby rivers have found fossil mud beds. Their hard consistency indicates especially prolonged desiccation, times of freshwater drought, sea level forcing up the water table, the last islands of savanna withering. Bone beds were also found underwater, broken teeth and fragments of the mandible and maxilla of a juvenile mastodon. Near the Macedon were the casts of dead trees, their roots upright, signs of their drowning still standing. The sea rose and fell during the night without incident. High tide had massed under our tents, wetting the floors, but receded before filling in. I kept waking, reaching a hand out of my sleeping bag and palming the damp floor, making sure it wasn't becoming a waterbed. The following tide had already come in by sunrise. What had been muddy shoals and oyster reefs at sunset became, in early light, an almost drowned landscape. Chest-tall rushes rippled across the marsh like savanna grass, so high we could barely see over them. Where we could find a view, the only thing out there was water and stranded islands of more marsh grass. The nearest land was miles away, a lone hammock, an isolated rise of palms and cedars. It looked to be just a short paddle away. An hour later, pushing in with the tide, we were still trying to find a route, squeezing into passages where rushes rasped against the hulls of our boats through a maze of loops and sloughs. The palm-headed hammock couldn't have been more than an acre of land. Close enough, we could almost throw a rock and hit it, but we couldn't seem to get there, nor were there any rocks. With the narrower tip of my kayak, I led the way. The channel widened into a lagoon. At the edges of this deep-bellied hole, two alligators lounged on opposite shores. Both of them slid into the water, one armored snout lingering above the surface to watch me before it vanished. The shadows of their bodies glided out of sight, the water murky and briny back here. A bush beer can floated in the rushes, carried in on the tide. I called back, "A couple alligators in this hole, big ones." "Alligators," I heard Alex say. "Understood." I can't say I delighted in the thought of large swimming reptiles underneath me, but I wasn't terrified. On the Zambezi, in Africa, where death by crocodile is common, I'd be scared, ice age scared. Here, I felt reasonably safe. These alligators wanted to get away from us, or so I told myself as I paddled above them. Below me, in the lagoon, they held their breath, not a bubble escaping. On the other side of the lagoon, we stowed our boats, where we could touch the edge of the hammock. This was an alligator island, their tracks lumbering across crusty mud. The mud had hardened into crackled saline, most of the palms dead and turned into bald pillars. 9 palms were alive, less than half the original population. Cedars had died long ago. This island is a sea-level marker, where hammocks are becoming sterile decade by decade, life reduced to a crust, cedars practically mineralized where they stand, ready to become future underwater evidence of a changing world. As seas rise, saline waters push the freshwater table farther inland. Every storm moves saltwater up a notch. At an elevation of about 2 feet, our hammock had just a few more big hurricane seasons before seawater would take it for good. Oyster shells had washed up on crusty ground, where fiddler crabs darted from hole to hole. The ground was pearled with the muddy fecal balls they'd fashioned, as if turning this dry oasis into a balled-up sculpture gallery. The surface was slightly moist and spongy, scraped with alligator claws, punctuated with the soft, rounded pads of a bobcat that came in from who knows where. Carefully, we moved into knee-high grass, watching for the snakes we imagined woven around us. Ospreys had been defecating in the barren cedar trees, branches and trunks scabbed with their white droppings. I climbed one of the dead cedars, finding enough altitude to feel the sway of a stiff spring breeze flowing toward the gulf. Rocking in clean air, this was the highest I'd been since we started along this nest of rivers. Until now, it was a matter of inches or a few feet above sea level. 15 feet changed everything. The larger land revealed itself. Inlets and tidal lagoons twisted around us. No wonder it took so long to find our way to this hammock. We were in a labyrinth. The far horizon, a gray line of cedars, many miles off. Their columnar trunks stepping back from the gulf, as they have been doing since the end of the Ice Age. I felt as if I were clinging to a bowsprit, as some ancestor must have done, climbing up to watch horizons disappear. "You lost your world," I thought. "The actual ground upon which you walked is now in the ocean." Chapter 8. Cult of the Fluted Point. 13,500 years ago. Tink, tink, tink. The musical sound of stone on stone. Marimba tones of an antler butt striking flint. Tink, tink, tink. Pieces shaped like angelfish flew to the ground. As the day warmed, the wall behind the flint napper brightened with morning sun. Autumn chill eased off as he swept and swiped at pieces of Wyoming chert, a kind of rock found in a Clovis cache, carried at least 300 miles over the Rocky Mountains and dropped under a boulder near a creek in what is now Boulder, Colorado. The napper was in a valley in southeast Utah. Cliffs and eroded rock towers guarded the horizon. Cottonwood trees were golden. He'd been to Wyoming and Texas to fetch good rocks, pigeon blood chert, and oily gray flint for making into weapons, a reasonable distance for rocks to be carried in the Clovis era. He studied the rock, feeling its heavy parts, its lightness. At his feet lay a mound of flakes from the hundreds of weapons and tools he'd made here. His hands were pressed and worn from a lifetime of banging on stone. "You can't fool the rock," he said, as he flipped it around in his hand. "You can a little, but not much." Sitting next to him in a folding chair, I scribbled in my journal, recording the making of a Clovis point by modern hands. Greg Nunn is a rock sage, a philosopher of stone. A master flint napper, he'd been doing this for most of his adult life. I'd commissioned him to produce a fluted Clovis point from the same chert found in the Boulder, Colorado cache. Tiger chert, a gray mahogany color banded with dark minerals. He said he had his own source for it on a mountainside in Wyoming. He keeps it secret. Some of his toolstone sites are so precious, he's filed mining claims to protect them. Nunn sat on a portable cottonwood stump in front of the south wall of his house, a spot that he preferred. He never liked working in winter, and thinks that Ice Age people would have agreed. "The rock doesn't respond well to cold," he said, "and it's a nightmare on your fingers. Autumn is good, a time of hunting, and warm, ethereal days, sunlight becoming long and rich." Already he was bleeding a little. "You have to get used to it," he said. "Every good point, you're going to bleed, especially Clovis." "These are aggressive strikes," he told me. "You just have to hog it out, make it or break it." The Clovis point, which seems to have developed first in the East between Florida and Maryland, was part of an almost codified toolkit of bone rods, preforms, scrapers, blades, and nearly identical flint napping tools. The utility of the bone rod, which is usually beveled at both ends, remains a mystery. It could be a weapon, or the handle of a butchering tool, or the shaft for a projectile. This collection of artifacts may be the equivalent of the tools and weapons traditionally used by indigenous whale hunters in the far north. In Point Hope, Alaska, early Inupiat whale hunters used the kalugiat, a lance made of a sharp piece of jade mounted on a long bone that is attached to an 8-foot wooden handle. This is used to kill the whale after it has been captured by driving the lance in close to the heart or liver or lungs. Once the whale is dead, a cutter called kaugok is used, made of slate or jade, the blade 1.5 feet long and 3 feet wide. This is for butchering. The hunters carry a pair of knives made of bones, one with a long, thin blade, the other with a rounded blade like a spatula. The long blade scrapes the sides of the boat where ice collects, and the other is for digging underneath the accumulated ice on the boat. The ancient whale hunt is a ritual, preceded by prayers and supplications to the new moon. Tools are readied and sharpened, and the hunters stay in a different place than their families. The Clovis mammoth hunt may have been similar, the weapons and tools prepared in ceremonial fashion, rubbed with red ochre until the beautiful stone could not be seen, bathed, as it were, in mineral blood. People quarried ochre back then, making cultural sites where they gathered the mineral from the ground. Clovis points without visible red on the surface have microscopic ochre traces in their cracks and pores. An archaeologist tells a story about taking a Clovis point to classrooms where hundreds of children handled it. No matter how many kids touched it, he still couldn't wear a white shirt without getting red on it. Nunn hadn't made a Clovis point in a few years. He came out of retirement for this one, knocking hard and snapping off pieces, alternating between using a rock cobble as a hammer and then the back end of an antler. He said, "I'm replicating a process that's part of a technology." He hopped the dark rock in his hand, saying that he saw Clovis less as a people than as an industry, a way of shaping weapons. People speaking different languages may have been engaged with these weapons in a way that transcended North America's many geographies. "I'm not hunting mammoth, but I'm mimicking what I see in the rock," he said. "I'm not a Clovis person. I'm understanding Clovis' strategy. I can see they were deliberate, methodical. They were thinking way ahead. They knew it was going to break, so they designed them so they knew where they were going to break." For several minutes at a time, Nunn seemed to fly through the rock, taking it from a big tab in his lap down to a teardrop shape the size of a serving dish on his knee. He slowed, struggling with a crystal core, a dense lens the size of a penny inside the rock. He blamed himself, saying he'd seen this coming, but hadn't worked around it correctly. "Now it's a problem," he said. Turning the rock and banging from one side, turning and banging from the other, he told me that if he hit it too hard or in the wrong place, he'd take off too much and have an even bigger problem. Too gentle, and the problem would become even more intractable, options running out. You find surrenders like this stone all over the country, half blanked and ready to be made into something else, but discarded. Maybe something better came along, or it was roughly fashioned at the moment out of necessity and then dropped and left behind. This is how people seeded the land, working through stone for thousands of years, soil glittering with flakes they left behind. Nunn is not a scientist. He is a hunter. He makes his own projectiles for taking down deer and elk. His experience on the land surpasses that of most archaeologists, who make weekend field trips and spend most of their professional lives in data and paper. Nunn knows the country by its shapes, how it breathes animals, where it shows the way and where it does not. He grew up on a ranch in this part of Utah, where his father was also a napper. Nunn inherited the curiosity, finding broken stone artifacts in the desert and replicating them. He made a profession out of napping, learning every stroke and turn of whatever technology he handled, classic American points, Danish daggers, fluted Clovis projectiles. Archaeologists come to him to understand the process, learning about napping techniques and how rocks were moved, where they came from, where they went. For research, he visited collectors, rock hounds who picked up spear points and arrowheads in the field, and he said, "Show me whatever you got." He'd run his fingers through flake scars, turning each artifact, seeing the ancient work with hammerstones and burins, the angle of their blows, the force of the strike. Clovis he thought of as a code, not an easy one to break. It was meant to be hard, he said. Not everyone could do it. Clovis was a way of working stone in an almost identical fashion from coast to coast, the same general morphometrics, like Pleistocene golden means found in Maine, California, Oregon, Florida, and places between. This implies connection, communication, a continent held together by a single technology 13,500 years ago. A fluted Clovis point employs a technique called the overshot flake, a blow precise and hard enough to knock out a long slivered wedge from edge to edge on the rock. Done imprecisely, the rock breaks in two, left useless but for making into blades and scrapers. Considering how far Nunn has to go to get his materials and how guarded his Tiger chert source is, he dislikes wasting rock. He said, "You see plenty of Clovis points without the overshot flake." This, he admitted, was probably an excuse for old, tired, or inexperienced nappers who didn't want to risk their rock. Nunn lined up his piece, etched a platform into its edge, swung a couple practice strokes from the pitted knob of a moose antler, and struck with a hard, downward arc. An overshot flake flew from the backside. He practically caught it with his hand. Flipping the thinned teardrop around, he studied the shallow trough he'd blown across it. "That was a good one," he said. Settling his body back to work, he said, "I don't want to get too mystical about this, but a rock has power or spirit, whatever you want to call it." A 1988 ethnographic study of hunter-gatherers in far northern Australia found that certain kinds of rock have cultural significance. People walked hundreds of miles to get them. Lester Hyatt, the late scholar of Australian Aboriginal societies, wrote, "At the quarry, the men spoke of the stone growing up in the ground. Only here, at Gilifichi, did true killing stone grow. The cross-sections of weathered rinds were compared to that of a kidney, with the best interior stone of pinky-gray silcrete referred to as djuker, or fat. An esoteric oblique meaning of this word is power. It is this mystical power, derived from supernatural sources integral to the site, that gives the Gilifichi stone blades their stupendous killing force. Once struck, man or beast is doomed." Hyatt wrote that the Gilifichi stone blades were prized and feared, and that they formed a key resource in a system of trade that helped integrate distant tribes into a single cultural complex. This is what none and most archaeologists see in the Clovis Age, a single cultural complex across the Americas with stupendous killing force. The rock for their points, sometimes gathered from hundreds of miles away, often chosen for color and pattern, some of the hardest rock to work, selected because it was visually striking. If you're going to kill, do it beautifully, powerfully. Choose the right stone. In 2009, landscapers installing a small koi pond at the residence of Pat Mahaffey in a hillside neighborhood of Boulder, Colorado, found a cache of Clovis artifacts, 83 stone knives, blades, blanks, and flakes that would date no later than 13,500 years ago. The rocks had been carried to the site from geologic sources up to 300 miles away. Based on what is called bag wear on the rocks, it appears to have been done in a single journey. The journey was from an upper corner of Utah, through Wyoming, into Colorado, and across the Rockies to the Front Range, with key resources picked up along the way. A sparkly butternut-colored quartzite was collected around the Uinta Mountains in northeast Utah, probably the first stop on a route, followed by an abundance of flakes and worked chunks of tiger chert, also known as Bridger Basin chert, from the Wyoming-Colorado border, just north of Dinosaur National Monument. This tiger chert is the same handsome, striated, nut-brown rock that Greg Nunn used to make his Utah point for me. Hard to work with, but appreciated for its banding and rich colors. Next is a milky blue-white Kremling chert, a fine quartz-like rock from the high elevations of Middle Park in north-central Colorado, just west of the Continental Divide from Boulder. The movement of rock defines the sphere of human reach, in this case following rivers and passes through Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. The Clovis Age moved jaspers, cherts, and flint. The places they picked them up, then stopped to work them, and ultimately put them down, reveal their paths. Doug Bamforth, from the University of Colorado, arrived at the Mahaffey home after landscapers had pulled out about 18 pounds of imported rock from underneath the boulder, where it had been hidden since the late Pleistocene. He found evidence of the same transport wear on both sides of the artifacts, meaning they traveled together, rubbing against each other in a relatively swift journey. "This suggests that they kept up a steady pace," Bamforth said. "They didn't stop for a couple months along the way." The cache in Boulder shows a west-to-east movement of rock, but the bigger trend found in at least 21 North American caches shows rocks moving southeast to northwest. Edwards Plateau chert from Buttermilk Creek in Texas ended up in Oklahoma and Colorado. An artifact of white chert that originated near St. Louis, Missouri, turned up in a central Washington cache 2,000 miles away. Technology seems to have moved with older Clovis finds in the east and more recent artifacts in the west. This curve travels from Florida up to Alaska, where fluted points 12,000 years old have been found near the diminished shores and islands of the Bering Land Bridge in western Alaska. This appears to be a splashback, a movement returning to where people came from. Clovis influence went south, too, with fluted points found from 11,000 years ago near the tip of South America, including a curious stemmed fluted combination found at Cueva Fell in far southern Chile. The lay of most Clovis caches on the continent forms a pattern, a swath from Washington to Texas, more finds on the eastern side of the Rockies than the western, none documented on either coast, and none in the southeast, although Clovis existed in all of those places. Most of the caches are near the intercontinental heads of long rivers, as if the entirety of North America was their playing field, the Rocky Mountain chain a convenient locator near the middle. Some archaeologists maintain that these distances were a matter of trade and not single journeys. Having walked the inner parks of Colorado, watching mountains appear ahead, pass by, and disappear behind me, I believe they could have it wrong. The land is easy to cross. Now a passenger train crosses the Rockies along the Mahaffey route. The California Zephyr is one of the only contiguous railroad passages over the mountains, a spectacular trip from the observation car. The route takes advantage of an ease in the terrain, broad open parks between mountains, and a river with headwaters that lead the way up and over. The train incidentally follows Clovis people who came through the last chain of mountains, where 13,000 years ago a passage had opened between retreating glaciers, connecting the west and east sides of the continent. Though the gorges are beautiful, the upper Colorado River wrestling far below the train, the most epic scenery on the Zephyr comes when the journey tops out. After 100 miles of mountainous terrain, the Rockies end in a 4,000-foot plunge to the Great Plains, the flat American interior. It feels like being hurled into the sky, fired out of the cannon of the mountains. Cities and towns spread across the plains, and rivers wind eastward, turning eventually into the Mississippi, leading to the Gulf of Mexico more than 1,000 miles away. This train is my regular commute when I need to get across the state from my home on Colorado's western slope to, say, a major airport on the state's Front Range. I am following a groove laid down thousands of years before me, as if every footstep falls inside of another. Even if we can't see it, we can bet we've been here before. The Clovis party carrying these rocks would have topped out at the crest of the Rockies above Boulder, in the same place. Bamforth thinks this would not have been a residential group, but a foray sent out to procure the raw materials and return in one shot. The area around Boulder does not have good toolstone. Fetching it may have involved a 600-mile round trip to the corner market, bringing back reduced pieces of Wyoming tiger chert, Utah quartzite, and a pale chert from the upper Colorado River. "I'm going to Boulder, and I know there's no decent rock out there," Bamforth said. "I might just make sure that we're not stranded." "Stiff little rascal," Nunn said. The tiger chert was giving him a hard time. I had asked him to make the point with this specific rock from Wyoming, a type carried by the Clovis party over the mountains to Boulder, and buried in what would be Mr. Mahaffey's yard. Hard but pretty, he called it. Not his favorite or most responsive rock, but pleasing to the eye. He'd selected this piece from his rock stash on the first morning, saying, "This one's got potential." He sat down on his cottonwood stump and started scratching and pounding. "Let's see what it looks like inside," he said. Big pieces flew, a third of the rock shed in just a few blows. "That got rid of some mass," he said. Flakes came off cleanly, like he planned. He reached down and picked up the best ones, fitting them back into place to admire the accuracy with which they separated. He said a fluted Clovis point is a high-risk weapon. Personally, he thought it wasn't worth the effort, unless all you wanted to do was make a specialized instrument, a beautiful mammoth killer, something that would stand out in the world of spear points and atlatl tips. He banged down with a cobble and didn't get the flake he wanted, only a puff of impact dust, smell of ozone. "You can hear the difference. Your ears are as much a tool as anything," he said. He took another swing. "You hear that? It was dull, not as sharp." On the third strike, the stone rang like crystal. A flake popped off the back. He picked it up from the ground and fit it back into place. "I could have drawn that with a pencil," he said. By the end of the second day, he had this 10-pound block down to a 10-ounce shape, a flattened missile. He apologized for how long it was taking. He said he would have done this in one day in his prime. A Clovis person might have finished the work from big block down to sharpened point in a few hours. As the spear point took shape, he used smaller and smaller tools, down to the point of a mule deer antler and a stone burin no bigger than a dice for scratching out the edges, making tiny platforms that he knocked off with a rounded river cobble, chosen so it fit like an egg in his hand. "These are the real treasures," he said. "A good hammerstone is hard to come by." When the afternoon sun dropped through the cottonwoods, his wall no longer in the light, he laid the almost finished point onto the flake pile, and we went inside for a beer. He told me we'd get back to the projectile in the morning. "There's no doubt in my mind they had big gatherings, big hunts," Nunn said at his kitchen table. "They were probably doing it long before Clovis, but Clovis is just when you start to see it." He said if he were hunting, he'd never use a Clovis point. "It's too much work. They're worth more sold to collectors than broken in the field. They're bought in cult-like fashion, this old design still all the rage, but still it was too much work," he thought, "for the hunt. I'd use a simple biface," he said, "not one of these." A cache at the Crowfield site in southwestern Ontario contained 182 stone artifacts, some of them still functional and others intentionally burned and destroyed. This has been taken as evidence of a sacred ritual. These were likely seen as more than just weapons. Magic may have been imbued, special killing stones gathered for their power and fashioned in strict tradition. The final touch is the flute, a channel knocked up both sides, starting at the base like a stamp, a chop. To be cataloged as a true Clovis point, heading into action, not a preform waiting to go, it needs the flute. On the third morning, in warm, clear sunlight, he popped fluted channels into either side. They were meager flutes, just enough to mark it as a verifiable Clovis hunting weapon. Nunn wasn't impressed with his final product. "Tiger chert isn't easy," he said again. "To me, it was gorgeous. The projectile was thin as a letter envelope, and strong. It sounded like a musical instrument, the bar of a xylophone, as he placed it in my hand." "It's a Clovis point," Nunn said. "I've seen worse." Chapter 9. The Last Mammoth Hunt, 13,000 to 12,000 years ago. I sat with a friend on a dune crest, nothing else alive nearby but the sharp flares of a yucca sticking through sand. In an early December chill, we dug our bare feet into bone-white dunes. This desert forms a great blankness across southern New Mexico, visible from space. A lake used to be here, 2,000 square miles of crystalline surface against a shoreline of wooded mountains on one side and pure white gypsum beaches and grass on the other. Driven by heavy rainfall and meltwater catastrophes out of the Rocky Mountains, glaciers collapsing at a pace not seen for more than 10,000 years, the Rio Grande regularly jumped its banks and spilled through intermountain basins, filling this lake. People left artifacts around its shores, not many, but enough to tell of the presence of fluted weaponry. Stemmed points are plentiful along the intermountain lakes, hundreds of miles north of here, but this looks more like Clovis territory, an Ice Age outpost. Dunes once rolled into blue water, like the sand dune lagoons on the north coast of Brazil. The place is now pocked and sunbaked. Mountains on the other side of the basin roll onto their sides like capsized battleships, the forests that once grew there gone. A missile range lay between here and there. Several miles to the south, a black plume of smoke rose as if from a naval battle in a dry alabaster sea. A bomb had detonated, and something had caught fire, a dark fist of smoke thrust into the calm blue sky. Clovis people were used to environmental catastrophes, but this, the land turned alien and struck by human-made bombs, was not something they would have easily grasped. The end of any ice age is violent and unstable, giant floods, epic catastrophes. But how do you explain a country laid bare? The same shapes of mountains were here, the same contours of shorelines, but everything else had changed, down to airplanes blinking through stars and the nearby town of Alamogordo, New Mexico, lighting a corner of the sky at night like hellfire. Nick sat beside me, watching the smoke plume rise a couple hundred feet. He'd been a bomb tech in the war, Iraqi deployment, and worked at the White House for a 30-day stint, a alone in a park wearing the Hurt Locker suit as he inched around an abandoned briefcase while a news helicopter circled overhead. He told me it was one of the more riveting moments of his life, just him, a potential bomb, and all the world watching. We became friends when I taught at the University of Alaska, where he was a writing student. He came down to New Mexico to join me on a desert mission. I was looking for mammoths. He focused a pair of small field glasses on the explosion, its source hidden behind sand dunes. We'd been hearing atmospheric concussions all day, faraway explosions, surface-to-surface missiles launched from one end of the range to the other. He said the smoke could be anything, a personnel carrier, a tank, the shell of a helicopter suspended above ground on a cable as a target. He described to me a super-dense warhead made of depleted uranium, not an explosive, but a simple spear point for ripping through an armored tank, going in one side and out the other in a split second. It pierces a tank and leaves a hole the size of a baseball, he said. With his hands, he showed me how big the hole was. Anything not solid, like soldiers, would be instantly fired out of the tank through this aperture. He'd seen it done with a sheep. The animal was liquefied and sprayed across the ground. Then you can get in and drive away. No damage to the tank, he said. When we toured a military museum at one of the White Sands bases, wandering through a sculpture gallery of retired weaponry, missile launchers, rockets, and the white, bolted orbs of early atomic bomb casings, he started to laugh, saying, "This is what we do better than anything." "Killing?" I asked. "Killing," he said. "Hell yeah." He was thinking M16 rifles and hair-trigger bombs made to look like children's toys. I was thinking Clovis. Different parts of the same story. Thin, strong projectiles made of stone thrown silently through the air increased the sphere of the hunter. Small and scrawny as we are as a species, we have the influence of giants. Nick and I were accompanied by an itinerant mountaineering guide named Charlotte, and my buddy Jordan, a tall, lanky photographer from my Colorado hometown. Our sphere of influence felt like only our footprints, which blew away quickly in the wind. I wasn't the trip leader. I explained this up front. This was an exploratory mission, an arcane form of nomadism. No hierarchy, just pick up and go. We would move by consensus along the axis and edges of dunes, tents dropped between gentle swales and crests. I told them that if we ran into a fence with a sign reading U.S. government property, no trespassing, which would mean the edge of the missile range, I would not go over it. They could do whatever they wanted. Nick handed the binoculars to me, and I returned to scanning the blasted landscape beyond the dunes, the blistered lake bed up against the mountains. Mammoth tracks had been discovered out there, off limits. I'd tried for 2 years to get permission, but the chain of military command denied the permit somewhere higher up. Instead, I walked the edges of the range, finding old bullets shot from airplanes, ground sprayed with old practice fire, sheer chance that tracks would ever survive out there. The tracks were made by Colombian mammoths, walking along wet, shallow shorelines, according to the paleontologists who worked on the missile range. In photographs, they look like circular ripples on still water, dabs of memory placed left, right, left, as the mammoths ambulated. The prints are not stone. They are made of soft sediments, slightly more resistant than the surrounding plain, the last part to erode. In a sense, they are still fresh, filled in and buried, but still soft. Once exposed, they don't last long, sometimes years, sometimes months. One researcher returned to record a trackway he'd spotted a year earlier, and it had been worn back into the gentle pan of the missile range, barely visible. After waiting tens of thousands of years, they come to the surface and are gone, as swift as a spark. Some of the tracks that have been found are from isolated individuals, and some are moving together as families, or perhaps the mammoths followed the same route at different times, much as African elephants do today with their long, deeply trodden trails to water. Some tracks are subtle, the shapes of big pancakes, domed slightly from the ground. Others rise proudly, sprouting like mushrooms from the crater-riddled playa. Impressions of toppled trees have also been found, pushed over and denuded, with branches broken off, like those left behind by modern African elephants. Only these animals were a few tons heavier, pushing over larger trees to feed on the upper branches, peeling off large sections of bark in the lean seasons. The hind paw print of a short-faced bear was documented here, toes and claws pushed off as it moved over plaster-like mud. Across what looks like an unending wasteland are hundreds of smaller crisscrossing stabs, marks of animals that weighed less than a ton, direwolf, horse, panther. When I looked beyond the dunes into beige oblivion, I pictured these animals moving along the shore, grazing and hunting around what were once grassy beach dunes. Their winter chill would have been sharper, but not unbearable, like the windy rawness of New York in winter. We'd gone barefoot in the morning, temperatures just under freezing, to let our soft arches and the nibs of our toes acclimate. Paleolithic people's feet would have been hardier. Even if they wore sandals and leggings, perishable items that have not survived, they would have been in constant and direct contact with their world. No doors to close behind them. Every night was stars. Sliding my feet under the sun-warmed upper inch of sand, I put the ice age back in place, seeing its hulking animal shapes in the distance. I thought of Nick and I as two hunters pausing atop a white beach dune. The mammoths were a few miles away, their humped shoulders and heads moving along the lake, tusks rocking back and forth to the rhythm of their stride. 14 mammoths and mastodon kill sites have been documented in North America, most of them associated with Clovis toolkits and projectiles. The number may seem low, but it represents only those where human agency is irrefutable, not just scavenged, but attacked with weapons. Countless more must remain undocumented. Europe, with 700,000 years of closely studied early human and hominid habitation, has turned up 21 proboscidian kill sites. And Africa, with more than a million years of big game hunting, has only 8 prehistoric elephant kills. The 14 found in North America stand out as a high number for a much shorter occupation. In their 2008 article, How Many Elephant Kills Are 14, archaeologists Nicole Wagaspeck and Todd Surovell called this the highest frequency of subsistence exploitation of proboscidia anywhere in the prehistoric world. Wagaspeck and Surovell sampled faunal remains from 33 Clovis sites across the country to see what the Clovis might have been hunting and butchering, and discovered that on average, the largest species were found more often. That is, more mammoths than hares. Rather than exploiting all the prey they came upon, these Clovis hunters were going for the largest animals. The 33 sample sites are almost exclusively top-heavy, mostly megafauna, with little else. The two archaeologists have been accused of cherry-picking their sites, but the abundance of large bones still stands out. Perhaps not everyone was hunting and eating proboscideans, but in some places, or at some times, that is exactly what they were doing. Smaller bones of snakes or deer would not have lasted so long, skewing the results, but these accumulations of hunted and butchered megafauna bones represent unique events. The two researchers conclude that people at these sites were engaged in the extensive and selective use of large-bodied prey. This does not mean that Clovis existed by mammoth alone, they wrote. Careful not to stir the hornet's nest, where some say Clovis were dedicated mammoth hunters, and some say they certainly were not. But with their data, they had to conclude, based on estimated encounter rates, Clovis hunter-gatherers often ignored opportunities to harvest smaller game species, likely in favor of obtaining a higher-ranked resource. Bruce Bradley, from the University of Exeter, considers Clovis and its penchant for hunting the largest animals a kind of cult. He points out that fluted technology spread from coast to coast within 200 years. "That's too fast," he told me. In the Paleolithic, at a time when tools could remain unchanged for tens of thousands of years, this would have been breakneck speed. Compared to historic models for birth rates and migrations among hunter-gatherers, the Clovis age looks like an explosion. Similarly fluted points made it as far as the bottom of South America and to the edge of the Bering Land Bridge in Alaska, with one possible specimen found in Siberia, making the land bridge a two-way street. Something more than hunting efficiency carried these fluted points to the ends of the New World. How do you become a man if you can't find the mammoth? Bradley said. I think the whole Clovis thing out in the far west was entirely going after mammoths, looking to get that status. We don't find that many Clovis settlements in the west. They were coming out here looking for that last population of mammoths so they could fulfill their religious duty. That's where they're encountering the local people and passing on their technology. Bradley, who has made a career out of the spread of lithic traditions, especially the unprecedented rise of Clovis, believes this